Welcome to Seeking Delphi. This is episode number 57, Update on Fuel Cells and Hydrogen with Bill Smith. I'm Mark Sackler. The future lives here. Back in February of 2017, Infinity Hydrogen and Fuel Cell founder and CEO Bill Smith was the second interview ever on this podcast. We discussed the potential for hydrogen fuel cells at a time when, frankly, not much was happening. But things have changed. Suddenly, global interest in hydrogen and hydrogen fuel cells is red hot. And one other change by way of disclosure, by the way, I recently joined Infinity as Director of Corporate Communication. So how has the technology, the market, the global interest changed? I spoke to Bill to get his take on where it is and why the sudden spike in interest. Bill, great to have you back on Seeking Delphi. How's it going?
It's going great. Thank you very much for this opportunity to share some of what we're doing with you again.
Back in early 2017, Bill, you were the second ever interview on Seeking Delphi. And at that time, the entire fuel cell and hydrogen space was pretty much treading water. You could almost say dead in the water. You even went so far as to say, maybe it'll be an overnight sensation in 20 or 30 years. That doesn't sound like an overnight sensation, but in fact, it's happened pretty much in the last year, which means less than 5 years. So what exactly is going on? What has changed in the last not quite 5 years?
I think it was overly pessimistic given where we are right now, but it seems like right now there's a confluence of several different trends that are all pushing this industry in a new direction with new energy. Of course, behind everything, there is more and more concern, more growing concern about climate change, about coming up with ways to help control the levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And hydrogen is one of the leading contenders for that. But in addition to that, there's been actions in the marketplace with some important customers, some important country investments that have helped push the industry in a more commercial direction. For instance, Amazon has committed itself to hydrogen fuel cell powered forklifts for what you can only imagine is a massive number of sites and systems. And that has helped create a commercial market for fuel cells manufactured by companies such as Plug Power. Countries such as Korea have made firm commitments to decarbonize and create a carbon-free future using fuel cells. And you know, they're putting their money behind that so that there's some of these trends across the globe that are starting to come together and investors are starting to take notice. And that really wasn't the case a few years ago. A few years ago, those things were germinating, but they really hadn't blossomed into what they are right now.
We're hearing all kinds of hype, both positive and negative, about hydrogen and hydrogen fuel cells these days. The Biden administration looking to invest a tremendous amount in hydrogen and fuel cells. On the other hand, Elon Musk calling fuel cells fool cells. Obviously, his bread is buttered on the side of batteries. But in terms of all the different areas where hydrogen and hydrogen fuel cells can be used, let's take a look at a little bit what's real and what isn't. And let's start with vehicles and transportation. We're seeing it used for a lot of different things. So what's going on there?
Well, I think kind of an important point behind vehicular applications is the success of battery-powered electric vehicles, because that's helped create and mature a whole infrastructure of technologies for fuel cell-powered electric vehicles, because fuel cell vehicles are electric vehicles. So everything from motors to power conversion equipment, all of that is shared by the fuel cell-powered vehicle industry, as well as the battery-powered car or other vehicle industry. And where fuel cells have, a special application is in missions or applications where large amounts of range or energy are required compared to batteries, because fuel cells separating power and energy allow you to optimize both functions. Batteries combine the two. So if you want to travel twice as far in a battery-powered vehicle, you simply put in twice as many batteries, but that means you suffer the size and weight and cost penalties of twice as many batteries. If you want to extend the range of a fuel cell powered vehicle by two times, all you do is you put in a larger tank so that as you get to these larger and larger applications, say for heavy duty trucks or for trains or for marine vessels, that's where fuel cells have an advantage. And realistically, hybrid systems that combine batteries with fuel cells allow you to take advantage of both technologies. And that in many cases is the right way to do it, is the winning way to do it.
It seems that the biggest roadblock to passenger vehicles becoming hydrogen or hydrogen taking over in that space is the lack of refueling infrastructure, which needs to be a lot more abundant than for long-haul trucks. But still, Toyota and others are moving on in that direction. So can this happen, or is it just a pipe dream?
I do see that getting somewhere, because even in fuel cell passenger vehicles, fuel cells still have a range advantage and a time to refuel advantage. So you can operate a fuel cell automobile with a range that's similar to what you have in an internal combustion engine vehicle. And then you can, when you need to fill up again, you can stop at your local hydrogen station and fill up in 5 minutes, just like you do now. For passenger vehicles, you replicate the consumer experience that you already have with passenger vehicles, only you can do it with an all-electric vehicle, a hydrogen-powered electric fuel cell vehicle. But what's, as you just mentioned, what's not there right now is the infrastructure to support that. And in some of the locations, like in Korea, like in Japan, there are national commitments to building up that infrastructure for refueling those vehicles. And as that emerges, I think you'll see the vehicles and the infrastructure grow organically together. But there are certainly advantages that even the fuel cell vehicles have right now compared to battery vehicles.
Perhaps one of the most interesting things to me right now is what's going on with hydrogen and major hydrogen projects as grid storage for renewable green energy. Just a tremendous uptick in announcement of new projects within the last year or two. Maybe almost a tenfold increase. So what's up with that?
You know, I do believe that that can be one of the very key early adopter markets, because while wind and solar are tremendous assets to decarbonize the grid, of course, the sun doesn't shine all the time and it sets at night and the wind doesn't blow all the time. So you have a built-in intermittency with systems like that when you try to put them on the grid and make those systems truly dispatchable. Now, what energy storage can do for you on the grid is to allow you to average out the wind and solar renewable power input and then put it into storage and then feed it out from storage so that you have a truly reliable grid. However, doing that with batteries alone can be cost prohibitive and weight prohibitive in some cases, but it certainly can be cost prohibitive. Whereas hydrogen, as I mentioned earlier, separating power and energy allows you to simply store more and more and more hydrogen by having additional tanks and additional hydrogen generation equipment. And that can be very, very cost effective. And unlike batteries, it won't self-discharge and you can store it from, say, the long summer days. You can store electricity for the short winter nights. And, that's a built-in advantage of hydrogen. As the cost of renewables comes down, as the cost of electricity generated by wind and by solar comes down, it's reaching a level where the cost of using that renewable electricity to generate green hydrogen becomes very competitive with other alternative sources for peaking or other ways to fill in that load problem on the grid.
Another potentially interesting use of hydrogen that's being discussed is the direct use of hydrogen without a fuel cell, for example, in an internal combustion engine, or the use of hydrogen for home heating. That's being discussed, I know, in the UK, among other places. So what's your take on that?
Hydrogen for combustion engines has been experimented with and used for years. Back in the 1980s, 1990s, BMW had a program where they were running their 12-cylinder BMW on stored liquid hydrogen, and it worked very well. For combustion processes, though, say in an automobile, it's less efficient than a fuel cell process. So for any given amount of hydrogen, you're going to get less range out of it, but it can work. So I think for vehicles where fuel cells are a practical option, and that can be for cars and for heavy trucks and other larger vehicles, it's not going to be advantageous to burn that hydrogen in a combustion engine because of the difference in efficiency. However, for applications such as commercial transport aircraft, where you need the very large amounts of energy you'll get out of the thrust of a typical jet engine, there it may be cost effective and weight effective to burn the hydrogen in that more conventional jet engine than to try to do it with a fuel cell, because fuel cells may not be able to step up to those levels of thrust in any practical sense in the near future.
Okay, so what about home heating? Is that an option?
It's an energy source. So certainly you can burn it and it will give off heat, and that'd be one approach to it. However, just like any boiler or other furnace, some of it's going to go up the stack as waste heat. If you use it to run a heat, say make electricity and either run a resistive heating in a home or run a heat pump, that might be a more cost-effective trade. But it's something that certainly could be done. Once you have hydrogen there and stored, you can convert that stored energy using any of the typical processes, from thermal processes to electricity and heat pump type processes. That'd be an option, but I think that's probably down the road quite a bit. Although if you have, say, off-grid home or off-grid factory or something, that might be a very practical option. But as long as you're connected to the grid, I would think that you might find the electrical uses of the hydrogen to be the way to go.
One of the things that is very easy to find confusing, I'm sure a lot of people do, I did it first, even as I joined Infinity and started to work with you, the colors of hydrogen. And there are many, but the three main ones that we hear about in the news are gray, blue, and green. What are these? What's the importance going forward? What can you tell us?
The way that hydrogen is primarily produced in the world today, especially for industrial processes, is by stripping hydrogen off of methane. And it's called reformation of natural gas to strip off the hydrogen. And that's cost-effective, especially in areas where you have low cost of natural gas. The gray hydrogen is the term used for the very, very conventional way of generating hydrogen by reformation with no capture or any other sequestration of the carbon dioxide that's produced in the process. Blue hydrogen is doing the same thing, but then capturing that carbon dioxide and sequestering it so that it doesn't contribute to the carbon dioxide load of the atmosphere. And green hydrogen is, what it says, is taking renewable energy that's a carbon-free source of energy to do water electrolysis to generate direct hydrogen directly from water. So taking the H2 out of H2O. So that's really the difference. Two of those, the gray and the blue, are based on using natural gas, and green is based on using solar and wind sources to power electrolysis.
At this point, Bill, I think I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you to update our listeners on what Infinity's up to these days. Tell us what's going on.
Sure. Our niche, of course, is aerospace and defense systems and space systems. And what I can say right now is it's extremely exciting. What's changed in our space over the past few years is, very recently, there's been a commitment to once again return to space, return to manned spacecraft missions. And that's an area where fuel cells are very compatible, where fuel cells shine. We can operate on the same propulsion reactants that launch the rocket, hydrogen and oxygen, and we can make electricity. We can make large amounts of electricity cleanly and quietly and vibration-free in space. And importantly, for manned missions, our waste product is water that's clean enough to drink, so that we match up very well with manned missions utilizing the reactants that are used for propulsion. We can operate basically on the boil-off extra reactant to provide power for the mission. And then we can provide drinking water for the astronauts once they're up there. So that's very exciting, again, that this new commitment for those types of missions. And then, but it's not just, say, government sponsored space missions, but there's a whole area of commercial space that's emerging. And we're finding application for our fuel cells and also for our zero gravity space environment compatible electrolyzers. As people are looking at creating their own commercial space stations, we can provide not only power, but we can provide life support oxygen for the astronauts that are on orbit. So just our space area is very exciting. And in addition to that, the same technologies are favored for future application to submersibles, to underwater missions. And there, we've been sponsored by the U.S. Navy over a number of years, developing systems that can be deployed in new generation unmanned underwater vehicles to provide extended range for missions that they're unable to complete right now with batteries. So we're excited about that. And then finally, for other aerospace and defense related applications, we've been funded by the FAA, the Federal Aviation Agency, doing studies and some technology development for application of these systems to commercial transport aircraft. Large prime contractors like Airbus have serious plans to utilize fuel cells across a number of different applications in transport aircraft, the kind of aircraft everybody flies on, from everything for supplementary power systems to actual generation of electricity for main propulsion. So there's a lot going on in that area right now. And our focus on these markets and having the kind of company that can provide this quality equipment to these markets has proven very beneficial.
I'm glad you brought up electrolyzers. They're a very important component in the equation to go green, to decarbonize. You need electrolyzers to generate hydrogen from water. They need a power source for them to work. And if that is a green source, such as solar or wind, you can then store the hydrogen as potential energy to then be used by a fuel cell to generate electricity. Now, you've got experience with that. You've done stuff with that. But going forward, there's a lot more potential for regenerative fuel cell systems like this, including potentially going entirely off-grid.
Sure. As you said, if you combine the two, electrolysis that generates hydrogen and oxygen by splitting the water molecule, and then you take that electrolysis system and mate it up to a fuel cell, you have, in effect, a water battery. You have a very cost-effective way to store large amounts of energy. And we have been developing different systems for different mission applications. In the case of the U.S. Navy, regenerative fuel cell systems that could be integrated into a mobile microgrid for deployed expeditionary forces. We're also working on a program right now with NASA for regenerative fuel cells that could be used on the surface of the moon, where they have an extreme problem. They have a nighttime that gets extremely cold and lasts for 2 weeks that conventional batteries have a very, very difficult time enduring. And then, as you mentioned earlier about the electrical grid, a large version of these systems mated up to the electrical grid can provide a way to finally make renewable systems that are intermittent, finally dispatchable. So combining the two into regenerative fuel cell systems is something that we've been doing for years. Our first one we made, I think, in 2005. We see application for that in many, many different areas, from spacecraft to aircraft to, like you mentioned before, the terrestrial power grid.
There is an issue here that I have to interject and ask you a question about, and that's the availability of water, because places that are long, for example, on sunlight, like the southwest of the U.S., certain areas in the Middle East, the Emirates, Saudi Arabia, they're short on water. Water is a major supply issue, and there seems to be a disconnect here. Look at Plug Power building a major green energy production facility in California where water is at a premium. There have been objections in some parts of the southwestern U.S. to even building these sites because of the water issues. How can we deal with this?
Well, yeah, first of all, when you're talking about regenerative fuel cells that combine electrolysis and the fuel cell process, the byproduct of the fuel cell product, your waste product, is water. so that you can recover the majority of the water that is consumed in electrolysis back in your fuel cell reaction. So you have minimal impact on the overall water supply. Where you do have concerns is if you're generating hydrogen and oxygen or hydrogen alone for applications that are going to be used for, say, vehicles. And those vehicles are going to drive across the countryside and emit water vapor. Now, there you will lose that water back to the sky unless you take measures to condense it and save it. So if you're in extreme conditions where you are doing that, you could do that, but that would be up to the vehicle designers to see whether it was really beneficial or not to save that water. In some cases, it may be.
One truly fascinating question that lies in all of this, Bill, much of the technology we rely on today, particularly our microelectronic digital economy, the very technology I'm using to create this podcast and that our listeners are using to listen to it, was accelerated by NASA's need to miniaturize back in the 60s. And then, of course, global positioning systems came out of NASA technology, satellite communications that we rely on every day. Where does what you're doing fit in with this? I mean, these extreme environments, space, underwater, does that have a way of translating to what all of us need?
Well, the immediate impact that we see that can be beneficial to Earth is that we have to make, because of where we're going, we have to make these systems extremely lightweight and extremely reliable. So what we've done is that we've been able to eliminate many parts of a fuel cell system or an electrolyzer system that operate independently, say for separating water and gas in space. And we're able to eliminate those and in the process, reduce the overall weight of the system and increase the reliability of the system. And then for terrestrial applications, that would result in reducing the cost of a system. So that the things we're doing in space right now to make things lighter and more reliable all translate directly to doing the same thing on the ground and also can make them more cost effective, can reduce the total cost of ownership. So that's where I see, just like was done for microelectronics, all of the technologies that were developed to make electronics lightweight and reliable for space translated into similar products for terrestrial use.
Well, Bill, it's time for me to put you on the spot now, because after all, this is a futurist podcast, and it's time for us to perhaps wrap this up looking at a longer term scenario, 10 years, perhaps a little bit more. Doesn't have to be best case, but what could reasonably the future of the whole hydrogen and fuel cell space look like 10 or 15 years from now?
Well, first of all, the older I get, the faster 10 years goes by. So maybe it's 10, maybe it's 20, but I think at some point or even further than that. But what I do see coming is, and this is very important in the area of electrolysis and utilization of hydrogen, is as the cost of renewables drops and as the world continues to emphasize the need for controlling carbon in the atmosphere, there's going to be a continuing pull in this direction to decarbonize our energy system. Everything from the grid to your home to your transportation systems, that is not going away. And it's not going to be met with fossil fuels. So the fossil fuels are on a trajectory that is leading them to be used less and less and less. And I think on this long-term scale, what's going to happen is going to be driven, I think, primarily by economics and secondarily by climate change, just knowing how decisions get made. But the economics are looking good right now, that when renewables costs and the capital cost of the equipment drops a little bit more, and even not that much more, you're going to reach a tipping point where to generate hydrogen to use for industrial processes is by renewable powered electrolysis is going to be more cost effective than doing it by conventional fossil fuel means. And when that happens, you'll see major sectors of the industrial world start to decarbonize their hydrogen-related processes, which is going to create markets that are going to be in the tens or hundreds of billions of dollars for these technologies and for hydrogen. And as that happens, the whole industry for transportation will have a pathway to also cost-effectively deploy hydrogen for energy usage. Now, batteries are going to be side by side. The battery technology revolution that's happened is helping hydrogen electric vehicles. Again, like I said earlier, many of the subsystems, the motors, the power conversion, the controllers, and all of that align. They can be the same ones can be used for hydrogen fuel cell cars and vehicles as are used for battery powered vehicles. So I think that you're going to see at some point when you reach that crossover and it becomes more expensive to use fossil fuels, even outside of the concerns for climate change, then you'll truly see a revolution because hydrogen is pretty fundamental. The cars that most people drive today powered by internal combustion engines, guess what? The energy is really coming from that hydrogen molecule that's in there. It's splitting off the hydrogen from the carbon is where you get most of your energy when you drive your car. And that hydrogen only now will still be providing the energy, only now it's going to be free of its carbon and will have a pathway to a carbon-free future.
What about the whole grid storage issue looking 10 years and more into the future?
Yeah, I think grid storage in the future, I consider that is a key part of that and kind of an obvious one. There is a market right now for renewables on the power grid that is really unmet when renewables don't have their wind available, don't have sunlight available. And by using hydrogen to level that out, I mean, that becomes an absolute no-brainer, basically, to use that to levelize the grid, doing it over longer periods of time, hybridized with batteries. So I think that that's going to be a kind of an automatic going down the road. Again, it's not going to happen overnight, and utilities want to make sure things are proven. Utilities like to buy systems that will last them 10, 20, 30 years with known economics. So but I can see that pathway being open and a logical one for the future.
Well, Bill, it has been a pleasure to have you on again, and I wish you nothing but success for the future.
Thank you very much for inviting me. I am really excited to have this opportunity to share this with you and hope for all of us that we can all be part of the solution for the future.
The more one studies the issues surrounding global decarbonization efforts, the more one realizes that no one technology can do the entire job. Batteries will continue to be important, but the role of hydrogen and hydrogen fuel cells will only climb. Relevant web links to this story can be found at www.seekingdelphi.com. If you like what you hear, you can subscribe to Seeking Delphi on Apple Podcasts, Player FM, or YouTube. We're also now on iHeartRadio, and of course, be sure to follow and like us on Twitter and Facebook. Thanks for joining me. My technical assistant is Mohammed Marouf. Until next time, I'm Mark Sackler.